So we expect Lumbarpasana to arrive today, and I thought to read something by him. This talk called Cultivating Gratitude. It was, this is a transcribed from a talk he gave here, here at Abhayagiri on November 10th, 2009. And I wasn't here then, but I, from my understanding, the context is that Yamplern asked a number of ajahns to give talks on gratitude, and then she compiled everything into this book that was printed on that, I think it was in 2010, something like that, in kind of a ceremony when the Bhikkhu Commons was open. So, all right, so here we go. On Saturday night, Ajahn Amaro talked on the theme of gratitude, and I'm going to speak on the same theme, mainly because Yamplern is putting us up to it. She was saying that people have been teasing her that she always prints books in Thai and never prints anything in English. She started thinking ahead and to the dedication ceremony of our new monks' utility building on July 4th this coming year. She wants to print a book and use Ajahn Liam's piece on gratitude that he wrote when he was here. She asked us if Ajahn Amaro and I would speak on gratitude, and then she'll take those talks, transcribe them, and put them into this little booklet for free distribution, which is this. I thought this was a wonderful idea. Of course, now I have to think of something to say. On a certain level, just that Yamplern had this kind of idea, that intention, something worthy of gratitude, a sense that somebody wants to help us out, somebody wants to do something that is a benefit to others. That's something to be grateful for. When people want to do that, we should pay attention to those things and recognize them. That's when a lot of gratitude comes, when we pay attention to others and to the efforts that they make. Also, when we put ourselves in the frame of mind that is willing to measure things not just from our own views, perspectives, and feelings, but is able to extend our perception and way of viewing things to how others feel, how they think, how they perceive, then there can be a lot of room for gratitude. There's a certain network that draws us together, empathy as well. There can be a lot of gratitude that comes into the heart when we're able to really extend ourselves beyond our own feelings, our own biases, and our own perspectives. That is actually a very important thing to reflect on, because so often when we tend to get caught up in how we feel, how we like things, and what we dislike, what we want, what we don't want, and we measure the world, measure ourselves, and measure others from that perspective. Inevitably, that ends up being very limited, very cramped, and crowded. If we follow this, the attitude is easy to drift into negativity, or just not to experience a sense of expansiveness in the heart, and that doesn't give much room for gratitude. There's something that I read not too long ago, a book by Robert Wright, The Evolution of God. One of the things that he said was that in Islam, when they speak about somebody who's a quote, unbeliever, somebody who's outside of the religion, the more literal translation of that is somebody who's ungrateful, which is a very interesting in terms of the perspective of that religion. I didn't get the whole context because I don't know enough about Islam, but it was a very interesting perspective for a world religion. It was interesting to see how they look at what is the criterion for somebody who is within the religion. That when somebody is a non-believer, that means a person who is not grateful. It's a very human experience in the sense that for somebody to cut off themselves from something depends on the inability to experience gratitude. It cuts off one from something very important, something that is the lifeblood of one's humanity. So that's a very interesting little fact that is worthy to reflect on or take note of. In reflecting on gratitude, there's a perspective created, a way of turning the mind away from the negative mental states. The tendency we all have is that if we reflect on things, it's easy to get caught in the negative. But in the way the Buddha has us investigate things, you can look at that which is the drawback or the painful aspect of something, but you can also look at what is the benefit, what is the upside. You can reflect on things in that way. When we live in the world, whether we're monastics or whether we're lay people, we're still swayed by the worldly winds. It's easy to get caught up by things. For example, we're really not necessarily wanting to be praised, but when there's praise, then we feel a little bit more comfortable. But when there's any kind of criticism or blame, then we get upset. We feel a sense of resentment or aversion, or get the feeling of defeat or frustration. Ajahn Chah would say when there was some kind of criticism or some kind of blame, you can just turn it around and you can actually reflect on what is in it to be grateful for. It is an opportunity to look at things, well, look at that, I was expecting some kind of praise. Or when somebody points out our faults, it's usually so painful to have somebody point out our faults. Ajahn Chah would say, well, you should be grateful for that opportunity. It's rare that one has that opportunity to have one's faults pointed out. Then you have an opportunity to grow from that. It's called turning on its head by giving oneself an opportunity to use gratitude to flip it over. In the same way, Ajahn Chah used to say, we spend a lot of time wanting to be in good health and resenting illness or sickness. I hear monks complaining, oh, I couldn't practice. The whole rains retreat, I was sick the entire time and I couldn't practice. Well, they should be grateful for the opportunity to recognize illness, sickness, and death. That's real practice when we have a chance to reflect on these real realities of human existence. But we tend to resent them or feel that practice is only good when things are going well and when we're able to reflect on the teachings in a really cogent and clear way. That's when we think the practice is good. But when there are some difficulties or when we're experiencing illness, then we tend to resent that. We tend to feel intimidated by it. Instead, there should be a sense that one can be grateful for these difficulties because we have the opportunity to learn from that. So it's just a simple act on reflecting, I can learn from that. I can learn from another aspect of human experience through that. So it's a way of turning the mind. The turning of the mind is an essential part of the practice, allows us to go beyond our comfort zone, to push the envelope a bit when we feel of what we feel is acceptable. This is useful because so much of our spiritual practice tends to involve expending a tremendous amount of effort trying to make everything comfortable, acceptable. It's not just our spiritual practice, it's the human condition. That's what human beings spend a huge amount of effort in doing, trying to make things comfortable, acceptable, secure, and resent or fear anything that's outside of that. So by using a quality like gratitude, it's a way of reflecting, I can learn from this, I can appreciate something that's outside my comfort zone, something that makes me work a bit harder. And sometimes what is especially supportive of our own practice is when we conceive that what I really need to do is get beyond my comfort zone. In fact, in practice, we really do need to push ourselves a bit. But then we also need to be cautious because oftentimes the pushing is just that. It's just pushing, or it's too forceful, or it has an edge of aversion or annihilation to it. I'm going to annihilate all these defilements. I'm going to destroy them. This tends to come from a very hard and almost unaccepting intention. When it comes from that attitude, it usually pushes back at us as well. What happens is it sets up a dynamic in the mind where the mind is not fully at ease. The heart is not really settled. When it's like this, where is that quality of gratitude? We tend to only transcend things in a genuine way when we rely on understanding. When we approach it from that perspective, we can put ourselves outside our comfort zone. Then we can have a sense of a spaciousness and the mind can truly settle. There's a discourse where the Buddha talks about the impossibility of realization for someone who is without gratitude, or we may be someone prone to stinginess. It's not just stinginess about material things so much as a narrow approach to experiencing the world. Without relinquishing this quality of stinginess, the mind is not able to experience the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana, stream entry, etc. The mind is not able to enter the more settled states of concentration or be open to insight or penetration. So it's the underlying quality of the mind that helps lay the foundation for the mind to settle and be clear. That's an important reflection in the sense of, what is it that allows the mind to fully settle? What are the qualities that allow the mind to genuinely be peaceful? It's the building of momentum of well-being, a momentum of wholesome mental states that allows the mind to really settle. Of course, gratitude is a powerful quality that allows the mind to be bright, and we can reflect on this as we sit down in meditation. We cross our legs, get ourselves up, get our posture upright, and rather than going into minding the breath immediately, in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath. We can reflect, what do I have to be grateful for? There's a different quality of mind that arises when we turn our mind to review and reflect. What are the things of worthy of gratitude? What are the occasions where others have helped me? What circumstances have been favorable? What are we experiencing right now that might not be necessarily so pleasant? We've all been around long enough to know the external conditions in terms of physical comfort, the world, the weather, the political climate, the social climate, the economic climate can be quite challenging. And then there can be those human beings we have to live with, and they can be really irritating sometimes. But if we focus on that, if we allow that to take over the mind, then it plays on as if on a loop that goes through our consciousness, and we end up getting negative or dull because we really we don't mindfully tune it out. But if we direct our attention to something like gratitude, and not just in a Pollyannish type of thing that tries to make everything look wonderful, but rather an attitude of, yes, there is all the rest of it, the difficulties, but I choose to look at something that helps my mind be bright, because that's what has real value in my life, and that's what I want to make much of in my life, that which brings brightness and clarity and peace. It's about how we turn our attention and reflect. For example, today we had a meal offering that was in honor of Jay. If we wanted to, we can think of all the odd characteristics that Jay had. But would that be useful? Instead, we can turn our attention to all the qualities that Jay brought us, things that are really worthy of gratitude. One of the things that had stuck in my mind for a long time, even to this day, concerning Jay, was from the time when he got cancer, when the cancer was really advancing. He was in a lot of his discomfort, and he was pretty thin, and he wasn't eating because there was cancer in his mouth. He was coming down and preparing meals for us, although he wasn't eating them himself. He was preparing meals for us and also coming down for the Katina Festival. He wasn't a people person, but he made a point of coming down for Katina last year. This was in 2008, just in order to be with people. And this past Katina, there was actually many people who mentioned that. People who don't come here all that often, and they remember Jay coming down here for last Katina. Those are the things that bring up a sense of gratitude in the mind. And everybody has those different qualities that are worthy of gratitude. Everybody has on a certain level. We have a picture of Ajahn Chah up here. We talk about Ajahn Chah being a great master who was a bright light for passing on the Dhamma to all of us, inspiring so many people. He was certainly that. And also, he could be really irritating and frustrating to be around. It's very easy to live with a dead teacher. You can really idolize a dead teacher, but a real human being is more complex, and that's similar for all of us. It's easy to be less forgiving with a real person. That's why we need to make a conscious effort in directing our thoughts of gratitude, because when we do that, we can realize the worth of that sense of gratitude, and it can gain a momentum in the heart. As I was saying before, when we direct our attention to something that brings a sense of well-being, a wholesome state of mind, that's what allows the mind to foster an ability to settle and be concentrated. So if one is aspiring to peaceful states of consciousness, to samadhi, then making a point of directing attention to those qualities of gratitude. But if you want to stay agitated or restless, then you can let the mind dwell on aversion and that sense of irritation with the world around you, because that doesn't allow the mind to be peaceful. To really give up, that's an act of relinquishment. When we actually relinquish that voice and that mind that goes, I should have done it like that. It shouldn't be that way. Why don't they do this? Why isn't it like that? And the complaint may be true. It may be right. But what's the result of that complaining? Is it helpful or appropriate to allow that to take over? In terms of training the mind and directing attention to the qualities that allow the mind to settle, to be peaceful, there's an act of relinquishment that's needed, the relinquishing letting go and directing attention towards gratitude. Gratitude and contentment, as the Buddha says in the Mangala Sutta, these are the highest blessings. These are blessings because they bring peace, they bring clarity. It's not something that we wait around for the conditions in the world or the conditions in our life to be perfect so that we can feel grateful for nice things and then have a sense of gratitude. But it's something that one brings attention to on a regular basis so that it becomes a habit of mind. It's a training. It's a skillful way of giving a sense of oomph to the mind that adds brightness to it. So gratitude is a quality not just for establishing social harmony or fulfilling some sort of duty externally on a communal level. Rather, it's a quality that has a very powerful ramification and affects the state of mind, the internal training of the heart. And when we pay attention to that, it's sowing the seeds for our real awakening to blossom within the heart.
Question for yourself and Debbie. I was curious. I know that like at Amaravati, when they first got there, over time things changed. Like it was very, almost militaristic, real gung-ho, a lot of masculine sort of energy in the beginning. Obviously spearheaded by Lumpur Sumedho. And then what I've heard is over time that shifted, it became apparent that a lot of that kind of energy, a lot of more sort of Dutanga practices and particular ways of approaching the practice from the Thai forest tradition weren't always helpful with Westerns. So there was some sort of softening in some areas, more emphasis on the Brahmaviharas and these aspects of the practice. And I'm curious, I know that this monastery started, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years after that had already been in place. So there had been a lot of ground already laid. But I'm curious if over time here, there's been any shifts that either of you have noticed in the way that Lumpur is taught or the general tenor of the space in the monastery.
It's hard to speak from a purely objective position because it's all my experience that I can speak from. But, I think first of all, remember, we had cohabits, you know, we had Ajahn Amaravati and Ajahn Pasana, so there was kind of a blend of what they came with. And, I think just from the stories I've heard, like, even with Ajahn Chah, Wat Pa Phong, as well as Amaravati, you know, oftentimes there's a tendency to really start out in very, you know, gung-ho kind of everybody joins in with all the dutangas, you know, the abbot says, let's do, whether it's all the issues around food or late night practice or, you know, like Ajahn Chah wrapping up and having everybody wrap up in all of their robes on the hottest day of the year, sitting after the meal for hours, you know, to develop a sense of equanimity towards discomfort. And then realizing that, you know, maybe you needed to back off a little bit over the years. So I've even heard that Ajahn Chah, you know, kind of modified, this is what I've heard from the Paul, that Ajahn Chah modified his kind of expectations or training style over the years, as we've heard Ajahn Sumedho as well do. So it seems to be a not uncommon thing. As people who are teachers get to learn what's effective and what isn't for a particular group of people. Not discounting the usefulness of some of those kinds of more austere practices in any way whatsoever, but maybe not making such a community-wide kind of a requirement. most of what we experienced in the first few years has pretty much held pretty constant. A little bit of easing up on some things, like really in the first several years we did all night one proceedings every week, like up till 6:30 in the morning, you know, no break at 3:30, anything like that. And we worked 6 days a week. We didn't work the one cross, but we worked the day after one cross, even staying up all night. there was work, and that was for a number of years until we kind of relaxed on that. So, you know, that was kind of like, you know, partly out of necessity, because we have a lot of stuff that need to be done. So that was one thing that has changed. And you know, I think this is where it gets to be a little bit more of a personal perspective. This is that Lumpal was harder on me than he is on anybody else now.
And I feel the same way.
Everybody feels the same way.
He was.
Yeah, he think he was too. Yeah, he's a pretty strict set of expectations for certain kinds of things, and you know, pointed out things a lot more to not just me but other people as well. In the other days, if he does now, I think he's probably after 40 some odd years of doing that. Probably just tired of it. And it's kind of, you know, leaves it to others to do some of those kinds of more strict training things. I mean, I think he appreciates those standards. He just doesn't, I think, have the energy maybe to keep on doing it, you know, after 40 years. Which is understandable. I've been trying to be a parent for so long and have to move into grandparent. You know, the nice parts of being able to do that, yeah.
I think in line with that is that you were so small and there was such a big gap between Maharaj and Amaro and then the next big group. And it was a very small community. So you were much more aware of what was going on. And now, everything's changed. The support's changed. Before there wasn't as much food, there wasn't a choice of tea, it was everything. It was just different because it was so new.
Right. And requisites were, as you were saying, tea time was like there's a pot of black tea and a tea of herbal tea, and that was it.
And the thing is, like, I remember, I think you have to remind me because I think this is really funny. We were talking in one time and saying, well, if we can ask for coffee, mate, then we should be able to ask for soy milk because that's tea time.
Right.
And we had it all planned out ahead of time. And I think when we asked him, he was like, oh, no, coffee meat's good enough, or something. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Because, soy milk was really expensive at that time mm-hmm. because it was all very new and, those kinds of things. So, just by circumstances, things have changed some. But I don't know, I think I'm pretty, there's still a lot of consistency, I think. There's, maybe 85% of the training is very similar. And just as you mentioned, there was that huge gap between, Ajahn Amaro and then me. At least for the first few years, and then Ajahn Suganto came on to be three years senior to me, so he was still pretty junior when he came too. So there was a need for Ajahn Pasmo and Ajahn Amaro to be much more on the line there, and then as people moved up and some of the training started to come from the Majjhima monks to the junior monks, then they were able to back off a little bit. That's just some impression.
He has gotten lighter.
Yeah.
Even during time here?
Even
during your time with him here?
Yeah. Not lighter in practice, but he's softer.
Mm.
That expression comes out more.
I think part of what he and Ajahn Sumedho maybe also realized was just that the Westerners tend to have a lot of self-criticism and a lot of guilt that maybe Thais don't have such a strong inclination towards, at least in a real heavy way. More Thais maybe are even more self-effacing, but not in a heavy, judgmental kind of a way, sort of a real, truly humble kind of a way. And so, a lot of heavy, expectations and rules and things like that tend not to create a real peaceful state of mind in some, in Westerners. And a bit more of kindness and self-forgiveness and all that kind of stuff is a little bit more useful. But having said that, you know, I think he also strongly really feels that, you know, we do have to test our limits, push our limits a bit, and not just kind of give into, you know, the tendencies of the mind for ease and comfort and that kind of thing. So that comes out in his teaching.
Also reflecting on Amaravati, because that Chitras and Amaravati were like, I think, the first Western monasteries. And so they were very gung-ho. People were very excited and that we were going to make this work, and there was that real strong energy of moving forward, and the community was getting bigger and bigger. I think things got lost and weren't seen, and then there was that big mass exodus where one left, and that was like the first time somebody disrobed in the monasteries in the West, and that was just like the dam broke, and then it was just this kind of mass exodus, and I think it was, they learned a lot from that.
I'm curious if you have a sense as to what they may have learned.
I think some of what Ajahn Kuradana was saying about Westerners just don't need to be ridden so hard in certain ways because they are so hard on themselves. And I know what we've developed here more, and I don't know what they do at Amaravati, is the whole concept of the circle meetings, the heart meetings, that came about because just to try to keep that communication open so people weren't, that people were communicating. And that seems to be more, the Thais, when there's Thai monks here, they're usually more awkward about those meetings. but for the Westerners, they seem to really be helpful with things like that. Just recognizing it's a different culture.
One thing of this place that I found amazing, one of the reasons I think it's working long term is I've never been to the European monasteries, but I've only seen this ever here and at Wapapong. It's the only really places I've really seen it where, like, the abbot or abbots empower members of the community to be in charge of different aspects of the monastery, whereas the normal Thai Krubajan style is like the abbot calls all the shots and nobody has any say, really.
Mm.
And that's something that I think is incredibly powerful. And, it's something about Lumpur Liam, Lumpur Cha, too, that Wapapong is run that way. It's really interesting.
Mm.
Or even Lumpur Pasano in the business meetings saying, like, I have a Nimo, does anybody have any objections? And of course nobody does. He's still like it's powerful that he even setting a good example.
I do recall at least once where he did express like an invitation. He's like, yeah, I think I want to do this. And there were like one or two voices in the community that were like, well, can we balance it with this or that? And he actually, you know, the situation turned. Like, you know, even though 90% of the time it just goes with what he thinks, he's genuinely open to junior members' opinions and stuff. And that was very similar to your, yeah, it was very touching, very, very telling about his humility and practice.
Yeah. That's true.
Very inspiring.
Yes.
So too, when you were saying about like how the community wasn't very big, something I've kind of noticed here where maybe there doesn't have to be nearly as much admonishment in terms of like core wat details, so to speak, because there's actually quite a bit of momentum.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody sort of participating in the group standards.
Mm-hmm.
And so things are just, I mean, if one pays attention, one can just pick up on a lot of the different things just by paying attention to what, you know, whatever it is 10 people are doing in you know, the wat rock cleanups or whatever is going on.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of inertia, so to speak.
Yeah, and that's a good point. You know, mm-hmm. We're still of the size that pretty much everybody does everything, you know, plus or minus, you know, bits and pieces, rather than people just kind of doing their own thing. And that's very instructive and cohesive.
Yeah, that maturation. I mean, people mature to communities.
Right.
That's the one of the big changes I see. I think the beginning of Ajahn Pasano did kind of come from that attitude of the he's the abbot and we do things the way he wants them to be done. Never remember with always issues would come up, like, especially when we had the Sima Jaws living here, like, they would feel like he would just make decisions and just sort of dictate without getting their input on, you know, like how it affects their, how they live here and stuff. And then he started really working at it. He was actually asking us to kind of point this out to him, where he was dictating. I remember just one time he seemed like get it overnight. He sort of really started changing and asking, instead of dictating, just sort of getting, you know, agreement. And then there was a situation where somebody wanted to come live here, and it was going to be really awkward, and he invited everybody who had a decision, and perhaps it was going to affect their quality of life here. And we had a meeting, and you know, I think it was like 10, it was even people outside the community, didn't actually live here. It was about 12 or 15 of us, and we went through, and you know, it was like, my recollection is like out of 15, it was like 13 people said no. Yes, this is the right time to have that person live here. Both Ajahn Amar and Ajahn Palsu thought that person should be invited. And then we took a vote, and it was 15-0, you know, not to invite that person to come live here. And we had a song that night. One of our worst faithful song was at that point. And I said, that was interesting. And he said, no, but you voted yes. I said, you know, do you think we made the wrong decision? He said, yes, I do. I said, but you voted for that. He said, well, sometimes it's better to be harmonious than it is to be right. And I remember telling him that, you know, the two things that really impressed me with that is one, that. And but the other one, too, is that, you know, a real sign of a leader is somebody who can, like, know who should be involved in meetings. And so, you know, just inviting people outside the community, some of the board members or the people, and listening to their advice and their reputations. Instead of just dictating. And that was one of the reasons I really love Lumpur.
You have the attitude of leadership, like a former boss of mine did, who I really admired. And this former boss had a song over her desk that I think exemplifies Lumpur in some ways too. And what it said was, I must hurry, for there they go, and I am their leader.
Do you know where that's from?
I don't know. Have you heard of it?
No.
I didn't create that one. Thinking that one poor would do the hearts. I think probably everybody who lived here had that. Certain. Mm-hmm. I remember, like, for myself, I was living in the cloth here. Maybe we were going to put a wooden stove in there for the summer. And so I asked for some help during the work period to get the firewood. He said, it's your lodging. You want me to do the firewood? So I spent the entire summer. You can think of Lumpur as, you know, sort of, you afternoons are for meditation. I worked every afternoon gathering firewood. And at the end of the year, we usually bought a eco-thermometer for it. Entire summer together, finally. All afternoon.
You used to also do things, because I remember, even if you hadn't done this for often, like, I didn't get to my kuti much, because in those early days, especially, there was so much in the office. And one time he was walking up the road, and I was a short way behind him, and he stopped, and he turned to me, and he goes, how's it going? And he said, there's sure a lot of weeds growing on your walking path.
Thank you. So bringing it to the theme of gratitude, I think people bring understanding that we do have a lot of gratitude for Hong Kong. A lot of gratitude that he's coming back today.